When lights went out each night and conversation died away, I would lie staring at the row of night lights across the aisle, thinking back over every detail of that extraordinary night when light itself had entered this drab wooden barracks. Was he still here? I wondered. Was it only because he was too dazzling for physical eyes that none of us could see him? I had grown discouraged about even attempting to tell others what I had seen. Discouraged and a little self-protective, too. I was enjoying the newfound companionship of the ward too much to risk being ostracized as an oddball. But for hours each night, I would recall every sight, every sound of that incredibly vivid time. First that hellish realm, where I had been permitted to look longest. Where people who no longer belonged to the earth could not escape it either, could not escape the involvements, the hungers, the pride they had allowed to dominate them here. Then the brief visit to a realm where ego had been left behind, where all was selfless search for truth, where I might almost have thought myself in heaven except for the final fleeting revelation. The glorious city. I had seen it for an instant only, yet of the whole experience it stood out clearest. Most workingly. What did it all mean? Why should such things have been shown to me, of all people? Above all, what was I supposed to do about it now? That was the question Fred Owen was asking, slumped in the armchair next to mine, timing his words between labored breaths. Did it make any real difference? In your life, I mean. In what you did. Otherwise it's all very fascinating, having an inside track to God and all that, but I can't see that it matters very much. An inside track. Did I detect a note of envy in those words? If so, it was obvious I had failed to get across the essence of the experience. This was no round trip to heaven, I reminded Fred. If I saw heaven at all, it was only at an enormous distance, unattainable by the person I then was, or could conceive of becoming. Nor did I believe that as a boy of 20 I had peered into the depths of hell. I had not seen, for instance, the lake of fire recorded in the Bible. But what I saw of the next life, as it was apparently being experienced by people very like myself, was hell enough. Enough to fill me with a lifelong terror of any attitude, habit, priority that would shape me for an existence like some of those I had seen. There had been no casual events for me since that night in Texas, I told Fred, no unimportant encounters with people. Every minute of every day since that time, I had been aware of the presence of a larger world. And strangely enough, it was the glory of that world, not the terror, that made my return to this life so hard. The contrast between the love of Jesus and the world in which I found myself having to go on living made the year following my illness the most difficult of my life. What difference has it made? Fred was asking me. To play it straight with him, as I agreed to do, I knew I would have to tell Fred, and tell him honestly, about what happened next. It was 3 weeks after my out-of-the-body encounter with Christ that Lieutenant Irvin stopped at my bed with unhoped-for good news. The Medical College of Virginia had held my entrance position open for me. As soon as I could make the trip east, I was to report for classes. Once again my convalescence became a race against time. Every day of missed classes meant more to make up, less chance of staying in the program. You've got to eat, Lieutenant Irvin would say each time she saw me. We're not allowed to show patients their charts, but I'll tell you for certain they won't let you out of here until you put on another 15 pounds. And so I ate, stuffing myself with mashed potatoes that stuck to my dry mouth like library paste, drinking milk until the sight of the metal urn made my stomach rise in my throat. At last, one clear windy day in late January, exactly a month after I had been scheduled to start medical school, I received my official discharge from Camp Barclay Hospital. I stood staring at the train ticket in my hands. The Army had reserved not just a seat but a sleeping berth for me leaving Abilene the following afternoon, an unheard of luxury for a private and an indication of the fact that I had a lot of recovering still to do. My discharge weight was on my papers, 134 pounds. 44 less than the 178 I had checked in with. And 134, I knew, was at least £15 higher than it had been. But the point was, I was going to MT school, they had saved my place for me. I telephoned my stepmother to tell her what time the train got to Richmond. She had been writing regularly all the time I was in the hospital, saying she understood I was too ill to feel like answering. I was glad to let it go at that. Glad for the hospital office that had kept her informed. I had never been much good at communicating with her. I stared out the window of the Pullman as the countryside rolled past. Texarkana, Little Rock. Memphis. Different trains, different engines picking up my coach as it traveled east. In West Virginia we began to climb toward Charleston. And then we were over the state line into Virginia. Covington, Clifton Forge, Waynesboro, how beautiful it all was. The swollen streams, the forests where I had camped with my scout troop. Then down the eastern slopes of the Blue Ridge to Charlottesville, and on at last to Richmond. It was growing dark again when we reached the city, 48 hours after I had boarded the train in Abilene. Below the elevated track, rush hour traffic crawled bumper to bumper through the slushy streets. Ahead in the early winter twilight I made out the vast red brick bulk of the Main Street depot. Heart hammering, I struggled into my overcoat. Whether from weakness or the excitement of being home, my legs were trembling and the weight of the coat nearly dragged me to the floor. Through the train window I could see that the station platform was jammed with travelers, most of them, like me, in uniform. Then I saw my stepmother. Tall, thinner than I remembered her, her waist-length brown hair caught into a bun beneath her hat, she was trotting along the platform, dragging 10-year-old Henry behind her. I dragged my gear from beneath the seat and struggled down the train aisle. In Abilene they had assigned someone to carry the heavy duffel aboard for me. Mother spotted me as I came down the steps. Next moment her arms were around me, while Henry tried to climb up my back. Mother said nothing about my appearance, but after a few steps she silently reached over and took the duffel bag from me. She led us to the elevator, too, instead of taking the stairs down to the street, all the while filling me in on family news. Bruce Gordon was in bed with a cold. Christmas had been lonely with Dad and me away. Mama Dabney 100 had invited me to Moss Side for breakfast next morning. Batter bread, you can be sure, before I had to report to MT school at 9 o'clock. Later that night, when Henry and Bruce Gordon were asleep, Mother and I sat in the living room with the Christmas eggnog she had saved till now. George? I looked up to find her brown eyes on mine. Something's happened to you, George. Is it anything you can talk about? I gave a helpless little shrug. As a child I had always suspected she could read my mind. And all at once, there in that familiar room, with the photo of Dad on the mantel, a curious thing happened. After trying for weeks to describe to someone else my out-of-the-body experience, I suddenly found myself doing it. Telling my stepmother, this woman with whom I had resisted communicating all 10, it was 3 weeks after my out-of-the-body encounter with Christ that Lieutenant Irvin stopped at my bed with unhoped-for good news. The Medical College of Virginia had held my entrance position open for me. As soon as I could make the trip east, I was to report for classes. Once again my convalescence became a race against time. Every day of missed classes meant more to make up, less chance of staying in the program. You've got to eat, Lieutenant Irvin would say each time she saw me. We're not allowed to show patients their charts, but I'll tell you for certain they won't let you out of here until you put on another 15 pounds. And so I ate, stuffing myself with mashed potatoes that stuck to my dry mouth like library paste, drinking milk until the sight of the metal urn made my stomach rise in my throat. At last, one clear windy day in late January, exactly a month after I had been scheduled to start medical school, I received my official discharge from Camp Barclay Hospital. I stood staring at the train ticket in my hands. The Army had reserved not just a seat but a sleeping berth for me leaving Abilene the following afternoon, an unheard of luxury for a private and an indication of the fact that I had a lot of recovering still to do. My discharge weight was on my papers, £134. 44 less than the 178 I had checked in with, and 134, I knew, was at least £15 higher than it had been. But the point was, I was going to school, they had saved my place for me. I telephoned my stepmother to tell her what time the train got to Richmond. She had been writing regularly all the time I was in the hospital, saying she understood I was too ill to feel like answering. I was glad to let it go at that. Glad for the hospital office that had kept her informed. I had never been much good at communicating with her. I stared out the window of the Pullman as the countryside rolled past. Texarkana, Little Rock, Memphis. Different trains, different engines picking up my coach as it traveled east. In West Virginia we began to climb toward Charleston. And then we were over the state line into Virginia. Covington, Clifton Forge, Waynesboro, how beautiful it all was. The swollen streams, the forests where I had camped with my scout troop. Then down the eastern slopes of the Blue Ridge, to Charlottesville, and on at last to Richmond. It was growing dark again when we reached the city, 48 hours after I had boarded the train in Abilene. Below the elevated track, rush hour traffic crawled bumper to bumper through the slushy streets. Ahead in the early winter twilight I made out the vast red brick bulk of the Main Street depot. Heart hammering, I struggled into my overcoat. Whether from weakness or the excitement of being home, my legs were trembling and the weight of the coat nearly dragged me to the floor. Through the train window I could see that the station platform was jammed with travelers, most of them, like me, in uniform. Then I saw my stepmother. Tall, thinner than I remembered her, her waist-length brown hair caught into a bun beneath her hat, she was trotting along the platform, dragging 10-year-old Henry behind her. I dragged my gear from beneath the seat and struggled down the train aisle. In Abilene they had assigned someone to carry the heavy duffel aboard for me. Mother spotted me as I came down the steps. Next moment her arms were around me, while Henry tried to climb up my back. Mother said nothing about my appearance but after a few steps she silently reached over and took the duffel bag from me. She led us to the elevator, too, instead of taking the stairs down to the street, all the while filling me in on family news. Bruce Gordon was in bed with a cold. Christmas had been lonely with Dad and me away. Mama Dabney 100 had invited me to Moss Side for breakfast next morning. Batter bread, you can be sure, before I had to report to school at 9 o'clock. Later that night, when Henry and Bruce Gordon were asleep, Mother and I sat in the living room with the Christmas eggnog she had saved till now. George? I looked up to find her brown eyes on mine. Something's happened to you, George. Is it anything you can talk about? I gave a helpless little shrug. As a child I had always suspected she could read my mind. And all at once, there in that familiar room, with the photo of Dad on the mantel, a curious thing happened. After trying for weeks to describe to someone else my out-of-the-body experience, I suddenly found myself doing it. Telling my stepmother, this woman with whom I had resisted communicating all my life. Expressing to her what I had not been able to say to anyone else. I heard myself describe how I had jumped out of bed and turned around to find a young man still lying there. I heard myself tell about the frantic flight toward Richmond. About returning to Camp Barkley and searching for myself. About the light, and the journey on which we set out. She listened without a word to the entire account, scarcely shifting her position on the couch, searching my face with those eyes that missed nothing. And as I talked I was aware of something just as amazing as this torrent of words, from a young man as tongue-itted as I was. It was not that she believed me, though she clearly did. It was something taking place in me, a startling change in viewpoint, so that all at once I was looking not at George Ritchie's stepmother, but at Mary Skeen Ritchie, a person with a life history of her own. For the first time in my life, I was seeing the courageous young woman who had taken on not only the role of mother to Mary Jane and me but disciplinarian as well, in a household where the father was home only on weekends. Although I continued to speak, I also heard something Dad had once told me, something that had never registered before, that it was our stepmother who had insisted on waiting 3 years before having children of her own, to give Mary Jane and me that long to have her to ourselves. I went on talking about the heavenly city and how I longed to see it closer. But what I was understanding for the first time was how threatened Mama Dabney had been by Dad's new marriage. Why she had reminded me so often that Mary Skeen was not my real mother. I recalled my teenage withdrawal, my sulks and hostility, but now I was seeing the heartache they had caused to the laughing woman sitting in front of me. When I finished my story, we were both silent for a long time. George, Mother whispered at last, God has entrusted you with enormous truths. He's doing it still, I thought. Even as I talked about the absolute acceptance I had encountered in him, a brand new ability to accept Mother for herself was born in me. What was the mysterious power in simply telling about this experience? I had wondered what God expected of me after such an encounter. Was this part of the answer? Just to talk about it? 11 But if my homecoming was even better than I hoped, starting school the next day was worse. I was more than a month behind the rest of the class. The pile of books they loaded me down with, I could hardly carry back to the house, let alone hope to read and comprehend. In the lectures his sons that week, the professors tossed out 10-syllable Latin words. All around me students were busy scribbling into notebooks while I was simply trying to understand what the topic was. My health worked against me, too. Simply walking between buildings on the campus left me exhausted, and concentrating on a lecture for more than a few minutes was impossible. Time after time in the evenings my head would snap erect and I would realize I had been sleeping at my desk. Each first-year student had been given an ordinary brown paper bag containing an assortment of human bones, rib, vertebra, ulna and radius, with which he was supposed to become familiar. One day I misplaced mine and anxiously retraced my steps to the anatomy lab. "Have you seen a bag of bones?" I asked a student standing in the doorway. He surveyed my emaciated form. "Sure, bud." Standing in front of me. Gradually I slid into a destructive cycle. Worry at into my study time. Then I did poorly and worried even more. The others all seemed so secure, so confident of their facts. As the weeks passed I began to feel like a lone moron surrounded by geniuses. And then in May something wonderful happened. I had known Marguerite Schell for a couple of years, ever since her brother Bob joined the Phi Gams at the University of Richmond. Bob Schell quickly became my best friend, and I had first met Marguerite at his home in Laurenceville, a small town about 70 miles south of Richmond. A petite, brown-haired girl with blue eyes the color of the sky on an April morning, I thought Marguerite Schell was the most beautiful girl I had ever seen. But as for dating her, I knew I did not stand a chance. She was extremely popular. In fact, soon after we met she was pinned to another fraternity brother of mine. Bob Schell was now in the Navy V-12 program at the University of Richmond. One night he phoned with some news. Marguerite and her boyfriend had split up. That was a surprise, but an even greater one was when I telephoned her for a date and she said yes. Gasoline was a problem with wartime rationing, but I talked Mama Dabney into loaning me her aqua-colored Oldsmobile and enough gas coupons for the round trip to Laurenceville. That 1941 Oldsmobile was one of the prettiest cars ever made, with its streamlined shape and chrome-ringed radiator, and I thought I made a pretty dashing sight as I pulled into the Schell's driveway. My self-esteem was somewhat flattened when Marguerite looked over my shoulder toward the car door and asked, "Where's Bob?" But though she had obviously been expecting both of us, she came out with me anyway and we had a wonderful evening. After that my spare time was spent begging 8-hour passes from school and gasoline coupons from the family. By midsummer I knew that more than I had ever wanted anything I wanted Marguerite to be my wife. I also knew I could not ask anyone to marry me without knowing about the most important event of my life. So several times I tried stumblingly to describe to Marguerite what had happened in the Berkeley Hospital. Each time I saw the sparkle die out of her face and her blue eyes grow anxious, and I would hastily change the subject. It was clear that she regarded the whole matter as a mental delusion. Anyhow, like many couples during the war, we tried to keep things pretty much on the surface, instinctively shying away from the subject of death and the future. And then in August, I was summoned to appear before one of the school's administrators. In his airless, small room, he told me that unless I made a B in both biochemistry and bacteriology at the end of the current marking period, I would be returned immediately to active duty. He said a lot more, uncomplimentary reflections on the dimensions of my brain and the mental incompetence of whoever had admitted me to the program, while I stood at attention in the 3 feet between the door and his desk, feeling the last shreds of self-confidence desert me. I was too wrapped up in my own problems to recognize that this man turned the same sarcastic tongue on all the students, part of a calculated strategy, no doubt, to winnow out before they reached the front as field doctors, all but the tough and self-reliant. To me, his assessment was simply the confirmation of my own: I was too dumb to be a doctor. For the next 6 weeks, as I bent over textbooks and microscopes, his words played like a broken record in my head. My final grades in the two subjects were D and D. On September 25th, I was called again to his office. His first words were crisp and official. 11, but if my homecoming was even better than I hoped, starting school the next day was worse. I was more than a month behind the rest of the class. The pile of books they loaded me down with, I could hardly carry back to the house, let alone hope to read and comprehend. In the lecture sessions that week, the professors tossed out 10-syllable Latin words. All around me, students were busy scribbling into notebooks while I was simply trying to understand what the topic was. My health worked against me, too. Simply walking between buildings on the campus left me exhausted, and concentrating on the lecture for more than a few minutes was impossible. Time after time in the evenings, my head would snap erect and I would realize I had been sleeping at my desk. Each first-year student had been given an ordinary brown paper bag containing an assortment of human bones, rib, vertebra, ulna and radius, with which he was supposed to become familiar. One day I misplaced mine and anxiously retraced my steps to the anatomy lab. "Have you seen a bag of bones?" I asked a student standing in the doorway. He surveyed my emaciated form. "Sure, bud." Standing in front of me. Gradually I slid into a destructive cycle. Worry ate into my study time. Then I did poorly and worried even more. The others all seemed so secure, so confident of their facts. As the weeks passed, I began to feel like a lone moron surrounded by geniuses. And then in May something wonderful happened. I had known Marguerite Schell for a couple of years, ever since her brother Bob joined the Phi Gams at the University of Richmond. Bob Schell quickly became my best friend, and I had first met Marguerite at his home in Laurenceville, a small town about 70 miles south of Richmond. A petite, brown-haired girl with blue eyes the color of the sky on an April morning, I thought Marguerite Schell was the most beautiful girl I had ever seen. But as for dating her, I knew I did not stand a chance. She was extremely popular. In fact, soon after we met, she was pinned to another fraternity brother of mine. Bob Schell was now in the Navy V-12 program at the University of Richmond. One night he phoned with some news: Marguerite and her boyfriend had split up. That was a surprise, but an even greater one was when I telephoned her for a date and she said, yes. Gasoline was a problem with wartime rationing, but I talked Mama Dabney into loaning me her aqua-colored Oldsmobile and enough gas coupons for the round trip to Laurenceville. That 1941 Oldsmobile was one of the prettiest cars ever made, with its streamlined shape and chrome-ringed radiator, and I thought I made a pretty dashing sight as I pulled into the Schell's driveway. My self-esteem was somewhat flattened when Marguerite looked over my shoulder toward the car door and asked, "Where's Bob?" But though she had obviously been expecting both of us, she came out with me anyway and we had a wonderful evening. After that, my spare time was spent begging 8-hour passes from school and gasoline coupons from the family. By midsummer I knew that more than I had ever wanted anything, I wanted Marguerite to be my wife. I also knew I could not ask anyone to marry me without knowing about the most important event of my life, so several times I tried stumblingly to describe to Marguerite what had happened in the Berkeley Hospital. Each time I saw the sparkle die out of her face and her blue eyes grow anxious, and I would hastily change the subject. It was clear that she regarded the whole matter as a mental delusion. Anyhow, like many couples during the war, we tried to keep things pretty much on the surface, instinctively shying away from the subject of death and the future. And then in August, I was summoned to appear before one of the school's administrators. In his airless, small room, he told me that unless I made a B in both biochemistry and bacteriology at the end of the current marking period, I would be returned immediately to active duty. He said a lot more, uncomplimentary reflections on the dimensions of my brain and the mental incompetence of whoever had admitted me to the program, while I stood at attention in the 3 feet between the door and his desk, feeling the last shreds of self-confidence desert me. I was too wrapped up in my own problems to recognize that this man turned the same sarcastic tongue on all the students, part of a calculated strategy, no doubt, to winnow out before they reached the front as field doctors, all but the tough and self-reliant. To me, his assessment was simply the confirmation of my own: I was too dumb to be a doctor. For the next 6 weeks, as I bent over textbooks and microscopes, his words played like a broken record in my head. My final grades in the two subjects were D and D. On September 25th, I was called again to his office. His first words were crisp and official: reassignment to Camp Berkeley, effective immediately. Reclassification for active duty overseas, also effective as of this date. Then he added a personal note: Richie, if you get back from this war alive, I personally am going to see to it that you never get admitted into this medical school or any other. You've wasted the time of professors and staff, and you've kept out of the program a student who could have benefited from such an opportunity. I'm going to see that you never again squander the time and resources of the medical profession. I do not remember how I got out into the hallway. I only remember watching busy people passing briskly in front of me, people with places they had to be, and realizing that whether I walked to the right or to the left, up the stairs or down, it would not make the slightest difference to anyone on earth. It was the bleakest day of my life. It was also my 21st birthday. On the day when life was supposed to begin, mine had lost its purpose. What was left but to go back to drilling in the Texas dust, and eventually to walk into a bullet somewhere in Europe or Asia? Why, Jesus, I kept asking, why couldn't I have stayed with you in the first place? The worst of it was, Mother was planning a big surprise party for me that night. Marguerite, who was working then in Richmond, was coming. My sister Mary Jane, her husband was in the Pacific, would be there, and Marguerite's older sister and her husband, and lots of others. And there would be gifts and congratulations and cards full of good wishes for the future. I walked slowly to my locker, and took as long as I could about emptying it. Medical texts, notebooks full of ink-stained pages, my bag of bones. How could I ask Marguerite to marry me now, when I would have no way to support her after the war, even supposing I got back? How easy it would be, the thought came, to go up to the chemistry lab and mix a few ingredients in a beaker. I might be too stupid to be a doctor, but I had understood the lectures on poisons well enough, and I would not be the first exam student to take this way out. The picture was in my mind for only an instant, crowded out by another one. The suicides I had seen chained for how long in a realm where a minute could last an eternity, to the very situations they had tried to escape. If I could not face Marguerite's disappointment in me that night, how could I bear it for a timeless forever? I saw those tortured eyes, heard their "I'm sorry," endlessly repeated, never reaching the ears it was meant for, and I knew they would stand forever between me and any serious impulse to take my own life. I went to my birthday party. I blew out the candles on my cake, unwrapped ribbon and tissue paper, and laughed at the jokes about how much money doctors made. Then when the others were gone, I told Mother and Marguerite. They were wonderful about it, reminding me that a quarter of the class was always eliminated by that time. If not me, Marguerite pointed out, someone else would be feeling disappointment. Which only made me feel worse about the girl I was saying goodbye to.